Today we're going to discuss formal as we can get, well, formally, within quotes, what complex functions are. So complex functions are functions of complex numbers. So you can think of a complex function as some kind of, as a map from some open subset of the complex plane into the complex plane. You all know that U is some open set, and so this is known as the domain of the function. And this is F of U is the range. So some elementary examples. So for example, we have already seen this is a function is a is an example a good example of a complex function. Then we have various polynomials, so you can create complex functions out of a combination of powers of z. Now note that for this one, it's defined on the complex plane minus the origin. So it's co common to it's useful for certain purposes to think of at least for defining them. To think of complex functions as a pair of real functions of real variables. So if we write our complex variable z in terms of the real and imaginary real and an imaginary variables, then so a complex function can be written as the sum of two real functions. So U and V are real functions. Of X and Y. Now, there are many ways of defining complex functions. One would be to basically give an explicit formula like this. The other one is to take some well-known function defined on the real line or some real interval and then analytically continue it. What we're doing is we know this is a function well defined on the real line, and we just replace the argument by a complex number, a complex variable. And this kind of procedure r is roughly known as analytic continuation. I'm going to put analytic continuation in quotes because the word this expression analytic continuation has different meanings depending on the context, even within complex analysis. And this is an example, a kind of a very simple example of what we mean by analytic continuation. It's like we have a function defined on some real line or interval, and we continue it analytically to the whole of the complex plane, or as much of the complex plane as possible. So for example, let's see. So given Euler's formula, we can, you all know that we can write the circular functions in terms of exponentials like so. Then the natural definition of a sine function on the complex plane is just this. So once you have analytically continued a real function on into the complex plane, you know, you'll have to you have to investigate its property, right? Because it's now, its definition has been extended to a greater domain, and you don't know how it's going to behave on the rest of the, you know, on the on this extended domain. So you have to go and say, you have to ask various kind of questions. You basically have to play with that function. You know, remember when you first got your, well, in my days, it was a graphic calculator. You probably got your first computer in high school and you played with functions. Ah, what does this look like? So you have to go back and do this, except that this is more complicated because it's a complex function. So you go from, you have to see how the real part behaves, how the imaginary part behaves. Fortunately, we have Mathematica, and it is not difficult. There's this command called plot3D, which will allow you to plot the real and the imaginary part of these functions. So I would encourage you to, you know, if you haven't seen these kind of functions before, I would encourage you to kind of play with these functions and how they look visually. So, for example, we can ask, where are the zeros of this function? Okay, let's take the sine function. So, what are the values of z? Well, we take the defining, so this basically tells us that if we take this expression, equate it to zero, what we get is that zero is equal to e to the power 2iz. And as you know, that if you take the inverse of this, then the log of zero, so we get the expression that I 2 pi of n, where n is an integer, that's equals to 2i of z. In other words, z is pi of n. So the zeros of the sine function, of the extended sine function, is the same as the zeros of the usual sine function, right? Yes? No. Sorry? Oh, right. Yeah, okay. Oh, right, sorry, yeah. So, so this is, where's my eraser? Right. So this is, so e to the power I theta minus e to the power minus I theta is, that's zero, so e to the power I theta is, yeah, right. So then we have e to the power 2i theta is 1, right? So, yeah, sorry. Yeah. So. right. So, yeah, sorry. So similarly, from the cosine function, you basically get that the zeros of the cosine function are going to be at n plus half of pi. And so one thing that we have seen is that this guy is periodic. It's a periodic in the along the imaginary axis, right? Because, right? So, right. So this is. So it's not periodic along the real axis, of course, but it's periodic along the imaginary axis, right? So because of that, these functions So as a consequence of this, if we now define in a natural way what the sine hyperbolic functions are, then it turns out that the sine hyperbolic function and the cos hyperbolic function, they are periodic along the imaginary axis. Whereas this, of course, these guys are, of course, periodic along the real axis. So, and then we can ask, what are the inverse functions? So, so we've already seen a particular inverse function, the log, the inverse of the exponential function. But if you, so I'm just going to write down a list of some common, the inverse of some common trigonometric functions and derive one of them, the expression for one of them. So here are some expressions for the inverse of sine is, so how do we derive such an expression for a sine function? For the, sorry.
I think that we should add n and should also add plus or minus depending on the number of terms. Because we have a branch cutting point at infinity that stays. And branch cuts are from minus 1 to infinity and from 1 to infinity.
Right. So you saying plus minus over here?
Plus minus before the first I and NP there.
NP would do N pi, you mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, let's try to obtain it. We have to write something like in something.
Right.
It's equal to what? This equal to zero. Then I treat this expression as some a variable, so I just obtain a technique.
Right.
From this, I can write the roots of square
right
version, and so. the square root has two meanings. One minus z square. Then I'm getting the log from here.
Right.
So omega is equal to minus I log from Z plus one minus. So yes, I've obtained this formula,
right,
as you asked. But when we circle the zero at some big radius,
right,
we can neglect this unit.
When you start, you have a...
When I have some points, one minus one, I'm starting from something like here and circle.
Right, you have a large circle, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this changes at 4p when I end the circle. So the square root changes to 2p.
Right, right.
This also changes to 2p.
Right.
So that we obtained after the encircling a common multiplier 2p.
Okay.
We can separate it in different log, so it will be plus log I log of this. This is equal. So the big circle crosses the branch cuts.
Okay.
So we have
yeah,
something like this. And actually, when we change this, cross some of them, the sign changes and appears. So
right. So, okay, so this is the more, what you're saying is you're giving the expression of sine inverse, which is valid for the different branch cuts, right?
Yeah.
The different branches. So I don't know, I have to think about it, but what I...
actually a continuation of...
Oh, yes, it's tutorial?
Okay. About the
right, I see. Okay, so... but how many? So how many branches are you getting here?
Infinite number, and each one connected with two neighbors.
Two neighbors.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you mean by neighbors?
So one card to one neighbor, so other card to other neighbor.
Okay. Right. So.
And this actually corresponds to the inverse sine on real axis, which is something like this.
Right.
And so on, where we have those branch cuts, each of them is to matrix. This is one shift, this is another, and so on. This one shift, another. Mm. Yeah.
So, sorry, I'm not understanding how your branches are arranged here.
I'm watching at the real axis.
Right.
So that let's consider this function only on real.
Right.
It cross when it moves from one to minus one, they passes the branch cut.
Right, right.
One and then another.
Yeah.
But it's inverse sign, so we just can plot first of all it's this between 1 and minus 1, it's real.
Right.
So we can plot it. Something like this. Then
right,
we have branch, passing branch cut.
Right.
Then it goes there. Again, passing branch cut. And so on.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah. Sure. So, okay. So, what do you, so your name again?
Ivan.
So what Ivan is saying is that we have these two branch points
yeah,
on the
and infinity is
but
point.
Yeah, exactly. But each of these branches are infinite sheeted.
Yep.
Right. So.
As a log.
Yeah, as a log. Okay. Okay. I'll have to think about this. But thank you very much. So, okay. Cool. Thank you. So this is from yesterday's tutorial. So anyway. I was wondering if all of you followed this the derivation of this formula. If not, is there anyone for whom that I should do the derivation of this? Anyone? Yes, why not? Okay. So, because if you haven't seen it once, if you have seen it once, you've seen it. So, okay. So middle. Okay, I was told not to use the top board, so I'm not going to use the top board. But. So, okay. So, basically, starting from, I mean, most of you have seen this, but some of you haven't, so it's worth repeating. So let's do sine hyperbolic. Then that's the defining expression for sine hyperbolic. And let's call this some something called W. And then let's introduce a shorthand for e to the power z, which we call Q. Then this expression becomes Q minus 1 over Q equals to 2 over omega. Then from this we get a quadratic equation, which is Q squared minus 2 omega of Q minus 1. Now if you solve the quadratic equation, we get Q is omega plus minus square root of omega squared plus 1. Now when now notice that we know that from the real sine hyperbolic that when omega is 0, sine hyperbolic is 0, the argument is 0. So this implies omega equals to 0 implies z equals to 0. So with z, when z is equal to 0, our variable q is 1. So if you compare these values with this expression for q, you see that the sign that is consistent with these values is the plus sign. So we have Q equal to omega plus square root of omega squared plus 1. So, and what is Q? Q is e to the power right, Q is e to the power z. So on the other hand, Z is sine inverse, sine hyperbolic inverse of omega. So if you take this expression and plug it in here, then and take the log of this whole expression, then you arrive at and then so that's how these expressions are derived, and then you can go and explore the properties of this functions on the complex plane. And as Ivan was saying, you know, there is they have very rich sort of geometry associated with them. Anyway, so I'm just going to give you the expressions for some of the other common the inverse of the some of the common trigonometric functions. So, okay, let's see. So cos of inverse, and then cos of inverse is something like this. So I'm not really going into the multivalued nature of these functions because I haven't really thought about them. So now and important, all these functions are actually an example of what could be termed holomorphic functions. You have to actually make modifications to the domain to take into account their multivalued property. So you have to basically, you know, introduce Riemann surfaces. But even before we extend the validity of their domain, but even before that, they are holomorphic in some open set of the subset of the complex plane. So what I'm trying to kind of motivate is there's an idea of complex differentiability. So there's an idea of complex and this is an idea which is in addition and a little bit distinct from the idea of differentiability as a real function. And this is actually the class of functions that we are interested in complex functions and in complex analysis, turns out to be these functions which are differentiable in a complex sense. So let's take a complex function f and write it as two real functions. Then we demand that these real functions u and v, they are differentiable as real functions. So what does that mean? So we say that U is differentiable at some point x naught and y naught, if there exists real numbers a and b such that the expression for u in a neighborhood of these of this point is given by this expression, so what are all these things where h and k are some small they are some small number, and this is subject to the condition that as the point of HK go to zero, the mod of the ratio of R, they go to zero. So basically, this may seem a little perverse, the way of defining differentiability of a function in this way, but what we are trying to avoid is that avoiding dividing the division by this thing in the definition. What I'm trying to say is that this definition of differentiability of a function generalizes naturally to functions of more than more than one complex variable. So now that A and B have very natural interpretation as the partial derivative of U with respect to X at the point X naught and Y naught. Right, so we have that. So we also demand that the same be true for V, but for U and V to be differentiable as real functions, they don't have to be, so the derivatives of V don't have to be the same as the derivatives of U, of course. So all that but now we have some other constant and some other remainder function and C is then and D is this. So this is just saying in a long-winded way that U and V are differentiable as real functions. But we also demand that F is differentiable as a complex function, and what that means is the following, that in the neighborhood of Z naught, where Z naught is X naught plus I Y naught, and omega is H plus IK, that so all of these things, so where E is a complex constant whose real and imaginary parts are alpha and beta, and as you know, as omega goes to zero, as omega goes to zero, we demand this thing to go to zero. Now, if we now look at the real and the imaginary part of this expression, then let me just write down the, then from the real part, if you compare with these guys, you see that the role of A and B and C and D are taken by alpha beta, right? But the real and the imaginary part of this expression will both have alpha and beta, but their roles will be switched. So let's just do the real part. So if you take the real part, then the real part of this is u at x naught plus h, y naught plus k is u at x naught and y naught plus omega h times alpha and k times beta with a minus sign, and the real part of the remainder function. And the imaginary part of this expression is going to give you V, yada, 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 same thing, same argument. And so here, H multiplying beta and K multiplying alpha, right? And the imaginary part of the remainder function. So we know that the coefficient of H, which is alpha, has the interpretation of the x derivative, partial derivative. And here, the coefficient of H, which is here, it's, okay, so, and the coefficient of, here the coefficient of k has the interpretation of the y derivative, which is also alpha. So this is going to be, right? And on the other hand, if you take beta, beta has the interpretation of from this equation, so we see that complex differentiability in the complex sense, forces the real and the imaginary part of a complex function to satisfy these differential equations. So these differential equations are central to the whole subject. And so let me rewrite them so that they get their proper dues. And so these are the famous Cauchy-Riemann equations. And so this is the meaning of differentiability at a point, but if the function, so if f of z, the complex function, you know, satisfies Cauchy-Riemann in some open set U, and that the real and imaginary part of F are also differentiable as real functions. So there are two conditions. Then we say that F is holomorphic. Holomorphic in this open set U. Yes. Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So these are the Cauchy-Riemann equation. So let me give you some examples of functions which are holomorphic and functions which are not holomorphic, and then tell you a quick way of spotting who is holomorphic and who is not holomorphic. So suppose F1 is a function . So I'm writing it in terms of the real variables. And F2 and F3. So can somebody tell me, without using the Cauchy-Riemann equation explicitly, which of these functions are holomorphic and which aren't? Yes, Dalman? The only last one is holomorphic, right? So Dalman must be extremely fast in taking derivatives in his head or solving first-order coupled differential equations. No, he actually knows something that maybe not all of you know. So the easy way of spotting holomorphic function is to actually go to a different to rewrite those equations in terms of z and z bar. So we know what this is, but so then z bar is x minus iy. So it is, although there is a good geometric theory behind it, and I won't give it to you. You can actually treat z and z bar as independent variables. And so if you do so, so let's invert these relationships. So x is minus 2. Right? Do we need those? We probably do. There's no harm. So our aim is to express those equations in terms of derivative with respect to z and z bar. So what we do is that we use the chain rule from calculus, so which you know is this thing. And since we are treating z and z bar as independent variable, we have to write out two terms. And now if you use these expressions for z and z bar, we basically get d by dz plus d by dz bar. Similarly, the expression for d by dy, if you do the same thing, now has an I in front, and you have d by dz minus d by dz bar, right? So I'm not going to write over there because that thing probably blocks the view. So I'll just go over there. So now if we take the two Cauchy, the Cauchy-Riemann equation, and we can rewrite them as one complex equation. So I just do this, that d of u by d of x minus dv by dy plus I du by dy plus dv by dx equal to zero. Now what I do is that I replace d by dx and d by dy by these expressions. Then you go through the algebra and you'll see that the expressions that involve d by dz, they all cancel out. But the terms involving d by dz cancel out, but the terms involving d by dz bar, they survive. And this actually becomes or in other words, so this means that the solution of this equation is a function of z, not z bar. So if you find a function and you express it in terms of a complex, that it's a complex variable, and if you find that it only depends on the variable but not its conjugate, then you know that it's a holomorphic function, right? And that's how D'Alamil could say that, because we know that this guy, if you write it in terms of z, this is z squared times z bar. So this cannot be holomorphic because it's got z bar in it. And here we have the real is z plus z bar, right? Again, it's got the z bar in it. So, but this guy only has z. So therefore, this is a... in modern literature in physics, you will find this notation for holomorphic function. So simple consequences of a function when it's holomorphic. So if f is holomorphic, then suppose you have some two-dimensional vector out of the real and imaginary part, then using the Cauchy-Riemann equation, you can show that very easily that the divergence of this vector is zero, so it's diverges and curl-free, which kind of implies that, you know, a lot of very nicely behaved physical systems have zero divergence and zero curl. So this kind of suggests that holomorphic functions might have lots of applications in two-dimensional physics. And I'll just leave this for you to show. The other thing is that you can show that if f is holomorphic, then if you consider the line of constant u, so these are lines of constant u, and the lines of constant V. So these are the constant V lines, say. Then you can show that these guys are at 90 degrees always. So how do we do this? So if you consider the gradient of U, so the gradient of U is the speed or the velocity at which U changes. And if you take the dot product of that with the gradient of V, then you get del U, del X, del V, del X, plus del U, del Y, del V, del Y. And you use the Cauchy-Riemann in this factor, one of the Cauchy-Riemann in this factor, and you get and over here you use Cauchy-Riemann in this, basically turn everything into U. And that's zero. The other thing that you can show in a similar vein is that the speed, which is this thing, is actually equal. This of these two sets of curves. So, although I won't go into the detail of this, this is something important that I'll tell you, and you'll see the. maybe that's something that'll be in the tutorial. If you make a variable transformation which is holomorphic, so suppose you have some function f, some holomorphic function, and then you introduce some new variable, say omega, which is given by some expression like that. And if you express now the original function in terms of omega, so it's some different function, right? So then basically, you start with a holomorphic function, and by just doing a holomorphic change of variable, you end up with another holomorphic function. So now if you write out this in terms of U and V, so F is U plus IV, and G, it has some real and imaginary part as well, but these are different functions, right? Then this change of variable allows you to map from a certain set of U and V to a different sets of U and V. So if these were the curves of U and V, the constant U and V curve, then a holomorphic change of variable will allow you to map to some different sets of U and V curves. So this is, say, U, constant U, this is constant V. This is constant U, and this is constant V. But these properties of the angles between these two curves, sets of curves, remain being 90 degrees. This will be preserved because your new function is also holomorphic. So this doesn't look like 90 degrees, but it should. I'm bad at drawing. And so, so one of the consequences of this is, and this is the bit that I'm not going to show now, is if you draw a small triangle on your original, you know, surface, that gets mapped to maybe another small triangle. But what doesn't change is the angles. The angles of these triangles don't change. So small triangles get mapped to similar small triangles. And this map, maps which preserve the angles between curves, is known as conformal transformations. So hopefully we'll explore a little bit of these transformations in the tutorial.